This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: United Nations General Assembly votes overwhelmingly against the Israeli occupation and in support of Palestinian self-determination. The Syrian ambassador to the UN criticizes the Security Council's inaction against the occupation of Syria's territory. And the United States sets a grim double record, reporting more than 3,700 deaths and over 250,000 COVID-19 cases in 24 hours. Our top story for this half hour: the United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a draft resolution in support of Palestinian self-determination.
The result of the vote is as follows: in favor 168, against 5, abstentions 10. Draft resolution 2 is adopted.
Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki expressed his gratitude to the countries that voted in favor of the document. He called on the international community to find mechanisms to implement its obligations and resolutions to safeguard the rights of all peoples in the interest of maintaining international peace and security. The top diplomat also called on UN member states to fulfill their responsibility to protect the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. He further called on them to take practical measures against the Israeli occupation and those rogue states that further encourage Tel Aviv to commit crimes. Well, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned Israel's approval for the construction of thousands of illegal settlement units in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the OIC slammed Israel's colonial policy as a violation of international law. It said the policy is a clear breach of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to the Israeli settlement activities in the occupied territories. Israel has recently approved the construction of 8,300 settler units in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. The settlement construction is scheduled to begin by 2021 and will continue until 2040. Syria's UN ambassador says the Security Council has failed to address issues in the Arab country and has become a tool to serve Western countries' political agendas. Addressing a meeting of the United Nations Security Council on Syria, Bashar al-Jafari slammed the Council's inaction against the occupation of Syria's territory. He said the U.S. and Turkey have occupied parts of Syria's northern territory. Jafari also highlighted the Israeli occupation of Golan Heights in southern Syria. Addressing the same meeting, Iran's UN ambassador said the U.S. Forces in Syria are following a hidden agenda and must leave the country. Majid Takht-e Ravanchi said the American troops' presence in Syria is illegal. He also slammed Washington's unilateral sanctions on the war-torn country, stressing that the inhumane practice is targeting the most vulnerable people. We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a draft resolution in support of Palestinian self-determination. To offer us more insight on that story, we're joined by Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Mr. Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Professor Nimr, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your perspective on the UNGA draft resolution.
As a matter of fact, we know that the General Assembly in the United Nations and most of the countries around the world are in support of the Palestinian question. The fact that yesterday 168 countries voted for the benefit of this resolution on the GA concerning the self-determination, the right of self-determination for the Palestinian. This is not the first resolution anyway. Many resolutions regarding the self-determination for the Palestinian people had passed during the period before. But the new thing about it is just to confront what is going on by other decisions by America or the deal of the century. This is to say clearly that the right of the Palestinian to self-determination is secured in the United Nations, and it should be go ahead in a practical way. Now, till now we have resolutions, but there is no means of how to apply this self determination by the Palestinian. What is the means by the United Nations to implement these kind of resolutions on the ground? That's the question.
Well, how can the status quo change, Mr. Nim?
Well, from our point of view as Palestinian, I believe, personally speaking, I believe that also the Palestinian authority and the Palestinian leaders have also to understand the changes occurring during the last period, especially with the normalization of four Arab countries, and yet other countries are scheduled to come. Also, the Palestinian Authority have to reconsider their regional relations and to immediately start new negotiations with Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, with Hezbollah, and to determine where we are standing at this point. If America and Israel are having a kind of a coalition against the Palestinians, including some of the Arab countries, I think it is about time now for the Palestinian also to join the coalition against Israel and America. It's quite clear. In this way, we can, you know, make a kind of a step forward towards our struggle against this whole project called Israel in the region, and against all the plans by the Americans to destroy the whole region in general. I believe that a coalition with the Iranian, the Palestinian, the Lebanese, Lebanese and Syria and Iraq would make a huge step forward for the Palestinians, and they will put the Palestinians also in front of all the news concerning the United States. But the problem is that they are waiting for Biden to take over in America, and they are still believing in maybe negotiation or re-establish the negotiation again with Israel by Biden, or to restore the relationship with America again, which is, I think, a very bad choice.
All right, thanks a lot, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. And elsewhere, the United States sets a grim double record in terms of its new COVID-19 cases and fatalities. Over 3,700 died, and more than 250,000 cases were reported in 24 hours. The country has seen a marked spike in its infections for more than a month now. This is while almost 113,000 people are currently hospitalized due to the virus. The overall death toll stands at more than 307,000, and the total number of infections at nearly 17 million in the country. The U.S. started vaccinating healthcare workers and elderly people this week. Meanwhile, Brazil, which is the second worst affected country in terms of fatalities after the U.S., also reported a daily record of more than 70,000 cases. That brings the country's total confirmed cases to over 7 million with 182,000 deaths. Colin Campbell joined us earlier to give us an update on the COVID-19 situation in the U.S.
One of the things, of course, that is the big news here is the advent of the introduction of vaccines that has been released this week, and they're waiting for the acceptance of another vaccine coming from a company called Moderna. And what's interesting about this vaccine is that it's not going to be authorized by the FDA because of the record time in which it was created. In fact, it will be authorized for emergency use. Americans are looking at a very dubious situation where they have this vaccine that has not been approved, but one that is sorely needed, as we deal with that grim milestone of 300,000 deaths. And the climbing number of COVID-19 recipients, it's a very serious situation going into 2021. You have a homeless population that continues to be growing. You have a number of deaths that continue to be climbing because of COVID-19. You have a floundering economy. You have a president that seems to want to stay in office even though he has been elected out of office.
The COVID-19 pandemic in Europe shows no sign of slowing down as several countries impose new restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. Germany reported nearly 27,000 daily cases, bringing the total number of people who have contracted the virus to over 1.4 million. The country also announced nearly 700 new deaths. Germany went into lockdown on Wednesday to try to curb the spread of infection. Officials have warned that the situation is likely to get worse during Christmas. In the Czech Republic, total death toll surpassed 10,000. The country is one of the hardest hit in Europe during the second wave of the pandemic. It has also imposed a strict second lockdown over the holiday period. While COVID-19 infections and deaths keep surging across Europe, this has prompted several countries, including the United Kingdom and Germany, to impose tough restrictions ahead of Christmas. We discuss the situation in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
And joining us now for this news review is Jerome Hughes from Brussels and Sergio Castano, political analyst and commentator, joining us from Valladolid. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. It's a pleasure to have you both. I guess, Jerome, we're going to start with you. Give us the latest, if you could, please, bud.
I think, Daniel, we could break this down in terms of the conversations, the big debates that are happening here at the EU at the moment. You could say it's about restrictions, it's about travel, it's about vaccines. And, you know, you actually have a lot of people. It's not very public, it's not very official, but sort of anecdotally, you have a lot of people in Germany and in the Netherlands, for example, blaming Belgium, people in Belgium, for traveling across the border to socialize in those countries in recent times, because Belgium has been in a sort of a strict lockdown now for weeks, where no bars, cafes, restaurants open, curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 o'clock in the morning. And so they have been traveling, people have been traveling to the Netherlands and to Germany to socialize, and in fact there's a bit of a blame game going on there. So there's a lot of debate about restrictions, different countries doing different things. In Ireland, it was very much keeping things under control with strict restrictions. But now, since it's opened up its nightlife, you see that there is a rise again in cases. So Belgium seems to have it reasonably under control. We were hitting towards 20,000 cases a day, and now we're in and around, on average, 2,000 cases a day. But if you just look at some of the statistics, just in the past 24 hours, take France, 289 deaths, the UK, 612, Italy, 680, Germany, 749, Poland, 605 deaths. Even with those, just those five countries alone, you're talking about close to heading towards 3,000 additional deaths as a result of COVID-19. So this is a major, it's a major problem, and there are major concerns as well about the holiday period, because we do know, we've been speaking to travel correspondents who specialize in the area of travel and so on, and they're saying that there has been an increase in the number of bookings on the airlines, not only within the European Union, but also people traveling into the EU from, say, the United States, which of course is a major hotspot, and people returning home for Christmas, for the new year. That is a big problem as well. So we're, even though we have these new restrictions whereby the nightlife might be closed down in many countries, you're still going to have gatherings of people that don't normally socialize together, people returning home to socialize within a domestic environment where, you know, it's cold weather, so there wouldn't be great ventilation. So that's a big problem. And the other issue, just if I briefly mention it as well, about vaccines. You know, there is a lot of debate and there's acrimony here about the fact that the European Medicines Agency, which is responsible for giving the green light, for example, to the Pfizer vaccine. The Pfizer vaccine is being manufactured for the European market, for the UK, you could say. It's being manufactured in Antwerp here in Belgium. Of course, the other company involved, BioNTech, is a German firm. And yet, the 27 EU member states, we haven't had any vaccine yet. It hasn't been approved by the European Medicines Board, and yet you have the UK using it. So So there are a lot of disgruntled people looking on and saying, is this the European Union failing? Is this the European Union not showing strength, not showing power, dragging its feet in terms of approving this vaccine so that people, the most vulnerable people, when you look at the death tolls I've just mentioned, the most vulnerable people could get vaccinated? Then on the other hand, the European Commission and the officials are saying, look, we have to do a coordinated response. The 27 countries will start vaccinating at exactly the same time. We'll make sure that the vaccine has been properly approved by independent experts, and that's their argument on it.
So many tough and pressing challenges and questions, and with no precedent, no really a blueprint to go by, right? Thank you, Jerome. I'm going to swing over and welcome Mr. Sergio to the program. Sergio, your thoughts on how what's going on where you're at, and how do you feel the Spanish authorities have responded to the second wave of the outbreak?
Hello. The situation now in Spain is tough because politicians made different decisions each week. For example, last week, the government said that probably for Christmas they could reduce restrictions. Everyone was happy. Everyone was preparing Christmas, preparing different celebrations with family. And today, the central government said that probably they have to increase restrictions for next week because the figures today are hard, are in worse situation than previous week. And this is difficult to accept for people because we are exhausted after 9 months with this lockdown, because here in Spain we have restrictions until summer, and then just in September we'll recover restrictions. And for example, we cannot travel within the country. We cannot move from our region, and we have more restrictions. Bars and restaurants were closed in this region and in most of the regions until last week, but the government think about the possibility to close bars and restaurants again next week. And in this context, politicians, from my opinion, don't know what to do for the future. They don't forecast. They have a specific plan. They are waiting for the vaccine, but the vaccine are going to be the solution in the future, maybe in summer, after summer. But we need a solution now, and maybe they need to find a balance between restrictions and a little freedom for people, because on the contrary, maybe they can control figures, but there are going to be other problems, depression and social problems, because for example, these specific days, Christmas, and a special time for most of people here in Spain and also in other European countries, is the only time during the year where families are together. And for many people, maybe people living in other countries, that they plan to come here to Spain to enjoy these holidays during Christmas, they cannot come, they cannot stay with their families. And at the end, this is tough, and we can see a solution in the midterm, And we are waiting for this vaccine, and maybe after summer we will be able to recover life. But politicians have to make decisions all together, because here in Spain we have a division, and the central government has no capacity to rule in regional governments. So they have to ask for regional governments to implement new measures. And this is really difficult for everyone, for the politicians and also for the rest of the people who are suffering the consequences of politician decisions.
Desmond, I wish you both safe holidays, and do stay safe, both of you, until we speak to both of you again. Jerome Hughes from Brussels and Sergio Castano, they're joining us from Valladolid, and stay safe and bye-bye for now.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said working in a healthcare facility without water, sanitation, and hygiene is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment. He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19. But there's still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that financing keeps flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines." Data published by the World Health Organization, WHO, in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the general population, but account for 14% of global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is imperative. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers of UNICEF.org under the heading, UN Report Says Almost 2 Billion Depend on Health Centers Without Basic Water Services. Please stay with us for more of UNICEF.org's article. The World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned around 1.8 billion people are at heightened risk of COVID-19 and other diseases because they use or work in healthcare facilities without basic water services. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said working in a healthcare facility without water, without sanitation and hygiene, is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment. He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19 spreading, but there are still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. The report, Fundamentals First, Universal Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Services in Healthcare Facilities for Safe Quality Care, comes as COVID-19 is exposing key vulnerabilities within healthcare systems, including inadequate infection prevention and control. Water, sanitation, and hygiene are vital to the safety of healthcare workers and patients, yet provision of these services is not prioritized. Worldwide, one in four healthcare facilities has no water services. One in three does not have access to hand hygiene, where care is provided. One in 10 has no sanitation services, and one in 3 does not segregate waste safely. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said sending healthcare workers and people in need of treatment to facilities without clean water, without safe toilets or even soap puts their lives at risk. She said this was certainly true before the COVID-19 pandemic, but this year has made these disparities impossible to ignore. As we reimagine and shape a post-COVID world, making sure we are sending children and mothers to places of care equipped with adequate water, sanitation and hygiene services is not merely something we can and should do. It is an absolute must. The situation is worse. Is worst of all in the world's 47 least developed countries. One in two healthcare facilities in the least developing countries does not have basic drinking water. One in four healthcare facilities has no hand hygiene facilities at points of care. And three in five lack basic sanitation services. But this can be fixed. The report's preliminary estimate indicates that it would cost roughly $1 per capita to enable all 47 least developed countries to establish basic water service in healthcare facilities. On average, $0.2 per capita is needed each year to operate and maintain services. According to the report, immediate incremental investment in basic water and hygiene and healthcare have big returns. Improving hygiene in healthcare facilities is a best buy for tackling antimicrobial resistance. It reduces healthcare costs because it reduces healthcare-associated infections, which are costly to treat. It saves time as healthcare workers do not have to search for water for hand hygiene. Better hygiene also increases uptake of services. This all adds up to a return of $1.5 for every dollar invested. These services are especially critical for vulnerable populations, including pregnant mothers, newborn babies, and children. Improving water, sanitation, and hygiene services in healthcare facilities is particularly important around childbirth, when far too many mothers and newborn babies suffer and die, including from preventable conditions. Conditions like sepsis. Better water, sanitation, and hygiene services could save 1 million pregnant women and newborn babies' lives and reduce stillbirths. The report provides four main recommendations. Implement costed national roadmaps with appropriate financing. Monitor and regularly review progress in improving water, sanitation and hygiene services, practices and the enabling environment. Develop capacities to health workforce to sustain water, sanitation and hygiene services and promote and practice good hygiene. Integrate water, sanitation and hygiene into regular health sector planning, budgeting and programming, including COVID-19 response and recovery efforts to deliver quality services. Global water, sanitation and hygiene and health partners have shown their support for meeting global and country water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facility targets. By 2020, over 130 partners have committed resources, of which 34 have made dedicated financial commitments totaling $125 million. Nevertheless, implementation of the 2019 World Health Assembly resolution on water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities is uneven. Of the nearly 50 countries for which World Health Organization and UNICEF have data, 86% have updated standards and 70% have conducted initial assessments, which show that these areas are generally on track. Yet just a third of countries have costed national water, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facility roadmaps, and only 10% have included water, sanitation, and hygiene indicators in national health systems monitoring. More catalytic global funding, technical support, and domestic resourcing is needed to keep healthcare workers and patients safe and protected. Now an opportunity exists to build on existing efforts and commitments and integrate water, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities in all national COVID-19 plans, vaccine distribution, and economic recovery packages. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that finances keep flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines. Funding water, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities is among the most cost-effective investments that governments can make. Data published by the World Health Organization in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the population, but account for 14% of the global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is absolutely imperative." Tim Wainwright, chief executive at international charity WaterAid, said, "Millions have no option but to seek care from the 50% of healthcare facilities in the developing world which don't have clean water on the premises. This cannot continue. Every day, both healthcare workers' and patients' lives are being put at risk." Tim Wainwright added, "Without frontline healthcare workers being able to wash their hands, provide their patients with clean water, or have somewhere decent to go to the toilet, a hospital is not a hospital at all. It's a breeding ground for disease." The data in this year's report includes statistics for 165 countries from surveys representing 760,000 facilities. Compared to last year's baseline report, estimates were available for 125 countries with data from surveys representing 560,000 facilities. The data on county progress in implementing the World Health Assembly's resolution represents 47 countries. It is the first time that these data have been compiled and analyzed.
Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. According to the International Criminal Court, it has confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. And what do you think the ICC did when they found out this information? They closed the case. That's right. We will be taking a look at Western privilege in the international arena and the lack of accountabilities for lives lost or destroyed in developing countries in this debate this hour. I'd like to welcome to the program out of London, Press TV's Richard Sudan, and out in Edinburgh, author and commentator John White. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off with Richard. Well, Richard, tell me about what's being said on that side of things. It is quite curious that after admitting that there were war crimes committed, that the ICC then closed the case.
I mean, I think, Marzia, in your introduction, you mentioned the phrase Western privilege, and I think that's a really good starting point. I mean, frankly, there are going to be scores of human rights lawyers and experts, scores of anti-war activists that are going to be looking at the decision by the chief prosecutor, who said there's no case for the British to answer to, with utter disbelief, because in spite of all of the accounts, all of the testimony, all of the evidence that's been put forward, really, in addition to what we already knew, it seems something that, on the one hand, there's been some sort of admission that the British Army military command did indeed contribute to suspected war crimes committed against the Iraqi detainees. But on the other hand, you know, I think the decision mentioned that it's satisfied that the British authorities conducted their own investigation. On what planet, amid what semblance of fairness and true democracy, can the party which is being accused of committing the war crimes somehow be, you know, the vindicator that there were none committed? It beggars belief, and I suspect, you know, the international community is really looking at this decision with a kind of side-eye squint, you know, also in a sense of disbelief, as are much of the British people.
All right. Well, John, let me get you in on this conversation. What do you make of this? How is that, from a legal perspective, I mean, how does it make sense? So there is a court. The court says, yes, we see proof of war crimes being taken out and that's taken place, and yet the case is closed. And what type of signal, what message does this basically send to the world?
Well, good evening, Amina, and good evening, Richard. There are times when the truth is not enough, and when only the unvarnished truth will do. And when we come to an unvarnished truth of this development, let us be honest, this is not about Western privilege per se, this is about white supremacy. The problem disfiguring our world today is not the lack of democracy within states, it's the lack of democracy between states. And this merely confirms it, because what we have are a clutch of Western imperialist countries, of which the UK is a prime member, who do not see themselves as upholders of international laws, but arbiters of international laws, which means to say they get to decide what constitutes war crimes and what does not. And in this case, what we are seeing is the white supremacy of the British imperial state at work. Its soldiers can never be accused or prosecuted for committing war crimes. Because why? Because they're on the good side in this eternal war against the black and brown other. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
Hmm. Let me also welcome our next guest. Out of London, author and political commentator, Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Jonathan, the reason the ICC says it is dismissing this is because the UK is investigating itself. Your take on what exactly that means?
Well, there have really been two stages to the British investigation. For several years up until 2017 was something called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT, and they had legal teams in court which listened to the claims of people from Iraq who said that they had been tortured or mistreated in various ways. And there were well over 3,000 such claims. And although 70% were dismissed as perhaps unreliable, that still meant that hundreds of people had got legitimate claims. But in fact, the cases fell apart because of the evidence not being strong enough. And instead, what's happened is that now the British military themselves are looking into any prolonged appeals. And it was interesting that the ICC, in its judgment in abandoning the case, now has said that they did believe that the British military were looking at this. But of course, for the victims and their families, there is no justice in this.
Well, now, John, do you think that for international organizations such as the ICC, that the value of lives differ depending on the part of the world one is from?
Well, indeed, yes. We live in a world underpinned by the values of might is right rather than right is might. And the IEC in this decision has proven itself to be unfit for purpose. We need to move beyond this idea that a certain group of countries based on military might and economic power have the right to determine what is just and what is not just. If these were Iranian troops, if these were Venezuelan troops, if these were Cuban troops involved in these activities or accused of these activities, it would be an entirely different narrative. This is about imperialism, no ifs, no buts. And I just have to say this. I am appalled as a citizen of the United Kingdom how dehumanized people of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran have been treated in terms of their value. And they have been pushed outside the circle of human worth that is established in the name of Western imperialism. And this is a very, very sordid and squalid turn of events. And I hope many people in the West will finally wake up to the injustice and the barbarism and the cruelty that has been perpetuated in their name. And unless they do, the world is headed for perdition. This is nothing more than imperial power writ large. There is no justice here. There is no legal pretext here. It's all about power. And until we move beyond that, move into a world where it's about underpinned by justice, regardless of country, regardless of culture, then, I foresee that we're headed for a very bad end.
Jonathan, ICC Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the UK has been using mechanisms to investigate itself, but then admits that this 10-year investigation has not led to anyone being convicted. It's quite amazing that on the one hand, she's saying that they are capable of actually judging themselves, but on the other hand, no one has been convicted and paid a price. So as our other guest said, would it be the same thing if we were talking about another country such as Iran, or, as he said, Venezuela?
Well, it might well be different in those cases. One can't know unless a particular case comes before. As I mentioned earlier, the problem in the case of British soldiers in Iraq that the evidence was not strong enough linked to individual soldiers or commanders that would actually enable anybody to be successful.
Jonathan, who determined that the evidence was not strong enough? The ICC.
The ICC accepted what the British British government and British military had decided through the Iraqi
historic problem right there.
And that what we have a situation, though, I think we have to admit, and probably John would agree with me on this, is that the real problem is the whole idea of European or North American countries intervening in a situation such as Iraq. Many millions of people, including myself in Britain, demonstrated against the Iraq war and thought it was a terrible mistake. And those sorts of interventions in countries that have a completely different culture and ethnicity and so on almost inevitably lead to various types of abuses. And this is something which I think has to be approached, and I would say in two ways. First of all, that these sorts of interventions should not be entered into as lightly as they have in the past. And secondly, the rules of engagement need to be much more closely monitored so that people are not able to commit the sort of abuses which undoubtedly happened in the case of Iraq.
Jonathan, you're just jumping in here, listening to what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you say that they should not, these countries like the UK, should not be involved or not get involved very easily or lightly in these regions. But of course they do. And on the other hand, the ones who are paying the price are the people of this region, not the aggressors, not the ones that are coming in. At the end of the day, if we're looking at, for example, Iraq, that millions of people have been displaced. That country has never gone back to where it was prior to the war. Yes, Saddam Hussein is gone, but so is security and so many other things. And so many people have been tortured, and so much abuse has taken place. So then the question is, so who pays? Who pays? We're looking right now at the ICC saying, Well, the Brits are going to investigate themselves, but these were the same ones, based on a lie, who went into the country to begin with, that they had no right to go into, because, of course, we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I agree, Marzia, absolutely, that the intervention in 2003 was not only unjustified, but as many of us would believe, totally illegal. But we have a situation when you say who is going to pay for what has happened in Iraq, and it is a tragic case. It is unfortunately many of the individual citizens and the communities in Iraq who are paying the price, and it's a terribly high price, which is why there needs to be a complete rethink, of, as I said, of engagement in foreign wars and foreign interventions.
Okay. Let me get John. Jonathan. Let me get John back in on this. Yeah. John, do you think that this verdict from the ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda is connected at all to what happened back in September when Bensouda and the ICC ruled that there was enough evidence to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan, and after that ruling, the U.S. sanctioned her? Do you see any type of connection that perhaps there are threats, intimidation being exerted on her? Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, there's absolutely a connection here. I mean, but I just need to go back to something Jonathan said. Jonathan Fry is somebody that I hold in the highest esteem, but I must take exception to his description of the war in Iraq as a mistake. Nomenclature is very important before it unlocks the keys to human consciousness. This war was not a mistake, it was a crime. It was a war crime, it was an atrocity. And the problem that we have in British culture is that every war since the Second World War is perceived and is presented as a rerun of the Second World War, i.e. the good war, i.e. that we are the good guys in this war, and that who we are up against are the bad guys. Saddam's Hitler, Rouhani's Hitler, Maduro's Hitler, Castro's Hitler. Do you understand the pattern here? This is national myth presented to presented to the British public as reality. We are the good guys, we are never the bad guys, and our troops can never commit atrocities. Until we break free from these shackles of false consciousness, then I say the world will always be in a perennial state of destabilization, of chaos, of mayhem, and of huge human suffering. Peoples of the global south cannot afford our propaganda any longer, because it has been the result, it has been the product of their unremitting suffering. We must bring this to an end, and it's incumbent on people like me and Jonathan to be people in the West, in Britain, to make that case unremittingly, regardless of the personal cost to us and our careers.
Well, Jonathan, when the U.S. treats an international organization in the way that Washington treated the ICC, doesn't it show the lack of sovereignty and legitimacy that perhaps the ICC has to begin with?
Well, of course, the United States and its behavior is a particular case, which one shouldn't generalize with other countries necessarily in Europe. The United States has never been shy of putting pressure on other countries or institutions such as the ICC, and as you know, it refused to engage with the ICC and has withdrawn from other international treaties and organizations because it refuses to accept the universal nature of the international law and the rule of law. And as we've seen with the policy towards Iran, of course, and with maximum pressure under the Trump administration, they are prepared in Washington not only to put pressure from America, but also to coerce other countries to try to get them to follow suit. One hopes that this situation will change over the coming months, and certainly there is great resistance amongst many European countries into being coerced in that way, and there's great support for the work of the ICC amongst most European member states.
Well, John, the majority of cases prosecuted by the ICC deal with African countries. This seems to hint at the high level of abuse which has been committed by African leaders. However, if we look at the number of people killed and affected in Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S.-led coalition, one would assume that countries such as the U.K. and the U.S. should be at the top of the agenda of ICC for investigating and prosecuting war crimes. Your thoughts?
Well, Malcolm X said it best, Amina. If you don't understand what's going on in the Congo, you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi. There is a circular relationship between the social and economic injustice taking place in Western countries and the foreign policy of imperialism, colonialism, and oppression that is underway perennially by those same Western countries. And people who are the victims of oppression in those Western countries, until they wake up to the reality of their condition and the whys and wherefores, then there will never be freedom for the rest of the world. And I just hope and pray that people in the US, people, the 40 million who lack healthcare, the families of the over 200,000 who have died from COVID, the families of the over 60,000 who have died from COVID in the UK, they wake up to the reality and move beyond the propaganda, the flag waving, the nationalism, the sense of patriotism. Until they move beyond that, then the world, never mind themselves, but the world will not be free. And I look forward to that day happening soon. I really do hope so.
Well, we all hope so, that's for sure. But Jonathan, when there is so much inequality in the international arena, even the criminal court, doesn't this send a message to developing countries that they must strengthen themselves militarily because might makes right?
Well, I certainly would agree that developing countries have every reason to be disappointed, to put it mildly, in the way that the ICC has tended to focus on Africa. There have been a few other cases recently which are a little more broad, but I would not particularly want to urge countries to spend their scarce resources on yet more military weapons. One of the problems of developing countries, including in Africa, is that too many governments spend far too much on arms and not enough on making sure that their populations are properly fed and educated. So although I can understand the resentment, I think rushing out to buy more arms is not the answer.
Well, your thoughts on that, John, because it seems that that is exactly the signal that is being sent, that you have to be strong militarily, and basically you can get away with anything. Now, what Jonathan said, when talking about African countries,
in theory, Jonathan is absolutely correct, but in reality, they have no choice because they're under risk of being invaded. Ask Muammar Gaddafi's ghost if he should have spent more money on arms, if he should have given up his chemical weapons program in 2003 when he did. Ask the people of Iraq. Ask the people of Iran who are suffering under these barbaric sanctions if they think their country should spend less on arms in order to put up a deterrence against the vultures that are circling their country right now. No, this is all about racism. It's racism writ large. It's colonialism, it's imperialism in our time. And imperialism is the external oppression of white supremacy. And until we move beyond white supremacy, there will be no progress and there will be no emancipation for the entire world.
How do we move beyond, John? How do we move beyond this white supremacy? What's
well, we
key
are
right now?
We are living in a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world, and the coming into being of the new. The rise of China, the strategic threat of Russia, that is the new world. The sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. But in the period in between is a period of struggle, and it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And that struggle is being waged now. And I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala inside this discussion makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have